This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Jenny Rothschild. She's a youth services librarian turned branch manager in Arlington, Virginia. You can find her book reviews at her blog at Bibliophile, which is at jenrothschild.com. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me today.
In our discussions leading up to the interview here, you brought up something that I didn't ask you about, but I do want you to explain. I want you to tell me and the listeners how teenagers are like zombies.
Okay. So I actually did once write an unpublished, like, 1,500-word piece on zombies as the perfect metaphor for teenagers. I think, like, at a basic level, when you hit puberty, you're just gross, you know, like, you have pus-filled boils, but zits are pretty close, you don't know where your legs and your arms are as you go through this gross part, and you're getting used to this new body, and, you know, you have all this weird hair and new smells, and, you know, your ears might not be falling off, but they might as well be. I think also whether you long to be part of the in crowd or if you're, you know, too cool for that and you sit in the back and just scoff at all the popular kids, there is kind of this like shuffling horde mentality. I mean, there's not a huge difference between, you know, Brains and Bieber. And I think also to go along with that is, when you are a teenager, you're struggling for autonomy and trying to break away from that and figuring out who you are and where you fit and everything. So I think one of the reasons zombies really resonate with teens is it's a paranormal thing that just, you know, relates a little too well to reality. What they're
coming through. They're lumbering around. And
exactly. Exactly.
They mumble to you a lot when you try to talk to them. So you do a lot of work in youth services, but you've also made the transition recently to being in management.
Yes.
Have you found that to be a hard transition, an easy transition? Are you enjoying the new stuff you're taking on?
I'm enjoying it. I think it was easier for me just because of my situation. I was a youth services librarian at a very small branch. And the branch was small enough that everyone at the branch kind of does everything. So I was the only one who did story time, but everyone was helping the kids do everything else. And I had to help a lot of adults do their stuff and help out with adult programming just because, you know, only four people work there. So we all had to do a little bit of everything. And when I became manager, of that branch. And so we still have, you know, everyone has to do a little bit of everything. So it's been a nice transition that way. And also because we currently don't have a youth services librarian at my branch, I'm still doing some of the youth services stuff to kind of like wean myself off. Hopefully we'll be getting a youth services librarian soon. And there are some things I'm really going to miss about it, but it's exciting. It's a whole new world of programming and things that I hadn't thought about a lot. But on the other hand, I get to program for like me and my friends and do some of that stuff like, oh, like what kind of programs do I want to see that I want to go to? And it's thinking about a different audience, which is, you know, kind of a fun way to grow. And I still get to keep my hand in youth services, so it's all good.
Yeah, because you said you also, as the manager, you're also doubling as the adult services librarian.
Yeah, because we are so small, the manager is also the adult services librarian, which is interesting because there's a bit of a learning curve there and there isn't as much support I'm finding, you know, like for youth services, there's 85 million listservs to be on. And there are, you know, there's YELSA and ALA and there's ELSC and ALA. And there's not like the adult services division of ALA. That's just kind of ALA in general, but ALA is so big. And so I'm trying to find, you know, my new people and to get the new support and figure stuff out. But it's, I luckily work with some really great people at other branches, and we meet a lot as a team. And so I'm getting a lot of support from them and bouncing ideas off of people. And
Well, and that's always a good thing about social media and stuff too, that you can make connections there and hopefully find your people soon there.
Exactly. Right now, most of my social media people are youth services people. So I need to find some more adults.
And how long have you been a children's or youth services librarian?
9 years. I was the youth services librarian at this branch for about a year before I became acting branch manager, and then I became permanent branch manager last week, actually. But then I was in a different library system for 8 years. And there I was a children's librarian, but I liked the teen stuff, and the teen department was understaffed, so I was allowed to play with them without stepping on toes. So I did a little bit of both. But yeah, 9 years total. So it's a very different world now without leaving my desk.
And what is it about teens that you like? Why do you like working with them?
They're just really fascinating people, as they're starting to make connections about the broader world around them, but they still have some of the innocence and hilarity of children, but with a much broader worldview. You know, you really start to see teens turn into the people that they're going to come into, and they have such a great outlook on things. I was talking to the kids at the middle school book club a few weeks ago, and we were talking about Hunger Games, and all of a sudden they're like, you know, what happens if you get your period in the arena? And they never talk about this in the book. So like, how is that going to affect everything? And they had this whole conversation about it, and I had never thought of that before. And I just think it's just really, really interesting to see them grow. It's almost like, you know, I have a toddler. I'm right. A mother. And mm-hmm. Just seeing, like, you know, as my kid figures out things like stairs and forks, and how Daniel Tiger's name is Daniel and her dad's name is Daniel, and whoa. And with teens, it's all mental, but it's almost kind of that same level of development as they make these connections and click as their world really starts to expand out to the much broader society and global issues. Well, it's really fun to watch.
Well, it's kind of like your development professionally, where as you're becoming a manager, you're having to become a much more, having to see the big picture a lot more and see how things fit together more than you do in larger things. So, and the kids are in the same way. I mean, as they get older, they have to see how different things fit together and things like that. That you're not going to go into that necessarily in a book, but that is a real world thing that would happen that you'd have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you have a bunch of teenage girls running around killing each other.
Yeah. You know, there's like a whole other issue that I was like,
So right now you said you're still doing a little bit of the youth services stuff until you get a new person. What kind of stuff do you guys regularly do for your teens?
So for teens, I'm at a very, very small branch. And so regularly, though, it's actually really cool. Our library system and our school system have a really awesome arrangement for our TAB group. And so the TAB groups meet at each of the middle schools, and a public librarian works with the school librarian. So we do it over lunch at the middle schools, which is great to get people there because they don't have to go anywhere. Right. There. And what they do, so the public librarians and the school librarians work together to see what the big books of the year are going to be. We look at which ones are getting a lot of buzz. We look at, you know, which popular series are going to have new books coming out. We look at the Best Fiction for Young Adults nominations and those sort of things. And we come up with this list of books. The public library buys a set for each of the middle schools. And then the middle schools have them in their libraries, but only the kids involved with TAB can check those books out and read them for that year. So it's kind of an extra incentive. Yeah. You're like, oh, only the TAB kids can read Allegiant and that sort of thing. And then after the year's done, the schools can put them in their library. And then the way it works, I know with the middle school I work with, the kids are reading off the cart all the time, but we get together every other week. And a lot of times they just kind of talk about whatever they're reading in general, which is sometimes a TAB book and sometimes something completely different. But it's a really interesting program, and I know it's, you know, a fairly rare program to have that kind of wonderful partnership with the schools and the money to be able to do that too. We are well funded, which is very, very nice. So we do that at my branch. I actually go every week because I meet with different grades. Like the kids meet every other week, but I'm there every week because it's different grades each week. And then during the summer, we do more programming as part of just the summer reading. We have fun programs. A perennial favorite is button making. We have a button machine and we come up with all sorts of small pictures of whoever's the big, you know, music and TV and movie stars and pop culture things. And the kids get to make buttons and magnets, which is great. A really fun program we did this year was Cupcake Wars, and that got turned out I was not prepared for. We actually had to do a team round for the second round because we didn't have enough cupcakes. I was like, wow, I thought I was going to be swimming in cupcakes for 3 weeks, guys. Cupcake decorating has always been popular in my system, and we kind of took it to the next level where I had different themes of how to decorate your cupcake, and I had them written down, you know, in a cup, and I drew a theme, and everyone had a cupcake and had to decorate their cupcake on the theme, and then everyone went around and explained and displayed their cupcake, and then we had to vote on who had the most awesome cupcake. And what I loved, it was really, really popular. The kids loved it. It was messy and great and delicious. But what I really loved about it was when they were going around talking about their cupcakes, they all had these really elaborate stories. Like we had an outer space theme and they're like, and here is the volcano of molten lava and these are the people running away and this gummy bear that fell over is someone who was killed by the alien overlord over here. And it wasn't always like the prettiest or best decorated cupcake that won, but rather whoever had the most insane story explaining what was going on with the massive frosting.
Most creative.
Exactly. Like for one of the cupcakes, for like the second round, it was a team round, and the theme was like meadow or forest or something. I can't remember. And one of the kids, their cupcake fell apart. They tried to cut it and it just was like this pile of crumbs. And they're like, can we just eat it now and forfeit? And I channeled my inner Tim Gunn and I told them just to make it work and just to work with it and make it work. And so they had this story about a tornado coming through and they, you know, kind of built around it with this scene of destruction and our tornado had come through and destroyed their cupcake and they ended up winning. No, it wasn't pretty because it was just like this pile of crumbs from something else gone wrong. But and I really liked that they had these great stories, but also that their peers appreciated the story because it was always the best story that won, not the best cupcake, which is interesting development I hadn't been expecting.
Right. Well, and that seems like that's the best way to engage, especially with teens, is to make it a fun program and make the library seem like a fun place to come because we are a fun place to come.
We are a very fun place. I have a slight issue and I'm trying to figure out ways and I've been working on this for a while, but we have a loft area. Like our second story is not actually a story. It's just the loft and there aren't books or anything up there, but it's just tables and it's where people go to study and work. And there's an entrance up there too. And I have a lot of teens who come after school and they never come downstairs. They just come to the loft and do their homework and do their group study. And then they leave and they use the upper door. So like we never see them. There's all these people who come into my library that we never actually see because they never come downstairs to where the actual library is.
Huh.
Which is interesting. And the other thing I work with the teens is the middle school I work with is a magnet school. And so we're not necessarily the neighborhood library for the students that I work with. A lot of them live closer to other branches because it draws students from all over the county. And so I'm not their neighborhood library. So I'm trying to, you know, convince them to come visit me anyway at my branch.
Right. Well, and you're right across, you said you're right across the Potomac from D.C. So there's probably a lot of people that work in D.C. that live there. Do you have are there a lot of people that live there year round, or do you have a lot of turnover from people coming in and out for various political postings and things like that? Or
for kind of like the 2030 something, it's a very transitional group of people, and it's hard. I mean, just as a resident, it's hard because my friends keep moving. You know, like people come in and we great make friends, and 3 weeks later they leave again. Right. And that's something that's kind of fun now that I'm on the adult side, is we've started a new committee called Lit Up, and it's to reach, the county calls them the Metro renters. And it is that 20, 30 something crowd, you know, and they come in for a year to work for an NGO or to work for the government before going to grad school or right after grad school. They're pretty cash poor, but they're going to be, you know, very financially successful later in life. So it's this weird demographic that we haven't been reaching out to. And we're starting to do new things to try to reach them, which is really fun. We had a ball, like an actual ball, this fall, which was super fun. The theme was Gatsby. Everyone dressed up in their flapper dresses and seersucker suits. The guy who won the costume contest actually came as Al Capone. it was at the art museum. There was a, I think it was like a 15-piece jazz band, and we had a dance troupe come in to kind of lead the Charleston dancing and display some really fancy footwork and flipping. And it was really, really fun and so successful with this age group. And it's actually a fundraiser for our 1,000 Books Before Kindergarten program, which targets a completely different age group. And that's going to happen again this fall, except this time the theme is James Bond from Russia with Love. So that'll be exciting. We're already thinking, like, all right, so what will the specialty cocktails be? Obviously a martini, maybe a Moscow Mule. Like, what else?
Vodka martini.
So. Well, yeah, and shaken, not stirred. And we're also doing some other things to reach that group. We have a commuter book club. So it's one that doesn't meet at the library. It actually meets at a restaurant, and it's after work. And then they tweet out the book discussion as well, so that if you can't quite, you know, if you're still, you know, on the bus or on the metro, on your way back out of town, you know, you can still participate in the book discussion group. And they have another, they have a monthly one called Books on Tap, which meets at this fun beer garden every month. And they don't read a specific book. They do a, more of a theme, like the five books that the five best books you've never actually read but keep pretending you do, or the five worst books you've ever read and want your time back, or the book where you just watched the movie and you pretend you read it. So kind of like general themes, which is more fun because I think also with a lot of with this age group, committing to reading a book every month is more than a lot of people want to do. So I think you just come and talk about books in general and not having to talk about a specific title.
Right.
We've actually been getting pretty good turnout with that. And we have some fun things that we're thinking of, like doing an after hours game night, or I'm trying to organize a bad poetry reading for National Poetry Month, which is something we actually used to do in college, where we just pulled out all of the super angsty poetry we wrote when we were teens. And, you know, read it with all of the angst that used to be in our hearts.
so
much hilarity.
So emo.
So emo. And such tortured rhyme schemes. So I'm thinking, you know, I'm working on trying to maybe do something like that on a broader scale, hopefully for National Poetry Month. We'll see, and partner with a local business that probably sells adult beverages to help everything. So that's kind of fun, is we're trying to reach that group and find ways to bring them in and also find ways to meet them where they are.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really important to reach out to that group, because it seems like a lot of times, I mean, we've talked about this with people in the past on the show, that, you know, we have all these great children's programs, these great teen programs, and then people kind of drop off until they have kids and then they come back to the library again. But you have this period of the 20s, and especially as people wait longer and longer in life to have kids, 20s and 30s, where they don't ever come to the library because they don't see why it's important. So I think it's really important to do programs like you guys are doing to keep them knowing why the library is important.
Yeah. And we're doing, like, we do outreach at coffee shops when the weather's nice. Like, we have a table outside Starbucks and our laptop and hotspot, so we can actually, like, sign you up for a library card and check books out for you, like, right there at Starbucks.
So do you bring, like, a mini collection with you so they can check out right away?
Yep. And we're doing more outreach like that, which is actually just really, really fun to talk to people at like different neighborhood festivals and at different places. I want to get into the gyms next to be like, hey, you're all watching stuff on your iPad or, you know, your smartphone while you work out. Did you know that you can stream independent movies for free from the library? Or check out ebooks and check out e-audiobooks?
Yeah, I was going to say audiobooks and stuff like that while you're exercising. Just listen. That's what I've done. That's what I've done a lot. But, I mean, I'm not currently a gym member, but back when I was, I would listen to I would listen to podcasts or audiobooks and stuff like that while I was doing it.
Yeah.
You probably get that a lot with your if you have a large commuter culture too, of the audiobooks too, because you can listen in the car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also it's our commuter culture. It's luckily it's more public transport, especially for we are just because parking in DC is insane. I think a lot of places, a lot of office buildings, is $25 a day to park.
Yeah, I forget that sometimes because I'm in Atlanta where we have very bad mass transits.
Yeah.
It exists, but it's not very good. It doesn't take you where you want it to go.
Yeah.
I forget there's places that actually have good mass transit.
Yeah, but it is a lot of audiobooks, a lot of ebooks. DC reads a lot. I mean, the metro area is regularly up there, like with the most literate cities. And it's very fun because you do take the metro into town during rush hour and everyone has a book.
That's great. Everyone's reading.
So, just kind of tap into that and let them know you can get the stuff for free at the library. And if you do the ebooks and the e-audio books, it'll return itself. So you don't have to worry about late fines, which is very helpful. But it's also interesting because, DC and it's multiple state lines. So there's a lot of public libraries all within, a 20-mile radius of each other.
Uh-huh, right.
Because each county has its own system, and then D.C. has its own system. And then there's a few other weird municipalities that have, systems within the larger county system, just because that's how everything developed over time. On the other hand, if you're an avid reader, you can game that pretty well. Like, oh, the Holds list for this book is 18 miles long at this library, but if I go over here, it's on the shelf.
Do a lot of the systems have reciprocal borrowing kind of agreements of working with each other? And
we don't. I mean, you can't the ILL stuff is weird. Mm. You can, if you return a book in the wrong system, it will eventually get back to the system, but it's going to be a few weeks or a month. But all of the systems do have, you can get a library card as long as you live within the greater metro area. And most of the systems see themselves as serving the greater metro area.
Okay, yes. So you don't have to live in your specific city to get
as long as you live, in the DC area, okay, we'll give you a card. And most of the systems are like that. I have cards and I have 4 or 5 cards for the area. I was on a YALSA selection list committee this past year, and I needed it as I tried to get all of these books. And, some systems had it and some systems didn't. And, the Holds list thing. And so driving all over, visiting 8 libraries in a day on my day off.
Well, that's a good transition because I did want to ask you about that. You were on the committee for the Outstanding Books for the College Bound and Lifelong Learners.
Yes.
Can you tell me about, if you can tell me about what that list is, just so the listeners can know what the list is and then how you kind of got involved with it and how it works.
Sure. So the Outstanding Books for the College Bound and Lifelong Learners is a different sort of list than the ones that YALSA usually puts out. This is a list that is revised every 5 years, so only comes out every 5 years. And, most of the lists only look at things that are published for young adults within the last publication year. This list doesn't have any restrictions on what you can put on it. It's pretty much any book that's widely available is eligible to be on the list. So it doesn't have to be a new book. It doesn't have to be an old book. It doesn't even have to be in print anymore, as long as a lot of libraries still carry it and people can access it. Which on one hand is really nice as you try to pull the list together, and on the other hand is insanely daunting because anything and everything is technically eligible. We did narrow it down that it had to be widely available in English just so the committee could read it and understand it. But the list, it's up to 125 books. It's divided into 5 subcategories, and those categories can change depending on the committee. We kept the same categories that have been on all of the lists in the 21st century, which are arts and humanities, history and cultures, literature and languages, science and technology, and social science. And each list can have up to 25 titles on it. And we were just really looking for books, like not necessarily the canon or here are the books that everyone should have read before they go to college, because I think those lists are already out there and it wasn't worth anyone's time just to recreate the canon. But books that are going to kind of open up new avenues of study or have you look at things different ways, you know, issues maybe you should know about, not necessarily works of literature, but greater issues that people should be thinking about and knowing about. And those sorts of things. It's a really fascinating list. I'm really, really proud of the list that the committee put together. It's great. And I got involved with it. I am an active YELSA member. And last year, I was on the committee for the YELSA Award for Excellence in Nonfiction for Young Adults, which is an award that needs a catchier name. That's it. I like a redundant mouthful of a title.
Or at least it needs a good acronym or something.
I know. I call it ENYA. A lot of people on the committee do call it the ENYA, but that's not necessarily the best name for it either. So it gets called. And I, you know, filled out a volunteer form to do another committee. I was actually hoping to be on the ALEX committee, which is adult books with high teen appeal. And they actually asked me to chair the Outstanding Books for the College Bound Committee instead. And I was like, sure, I'll do that. And it was really fun. It was interesting. I read a lot of books I never would have picked up, which was great because now I have new favorite authors that I never would have picked up had I not had to read it for the committee. And I did. I learned a lot of interesting things and read a lot of interesting things. And the list is up, fully annotated on the YELSA website, and I highly, highly recommend everyone check it out and find some new reading material.
And so I've had a few teen services people on the show recently, and I kind of have been asking everybody this. What is it about YA Lit that appeals to you as an adult to read? Like, why do you enjoy reading it? Not so much of just to find something good for Reader's Advisory, but what appeals to what appeals about that to you personally?
I think because everything's so new and not over the top, but teens in general feel just really, really strongly about things. Even their cynicism's overdone sometimes in a way. Like, I think a lot of adult books are just kind of like adults are bored as they try to figure stuff out, and they have like this very long view lens on life, you know, and I have that when I look at my life too, because I have the experience. I think teens, it's like, it's that first love, you know, it's your first kiss and everything's new and exciting and you're trying to figure it out. And there's an immediacy and a passion in this kind of over the top emotional response to everything, which draws you in more as a reader, you know, that kind of exuberance for everything, even when it's an exuberance of depression, which is kind of an odd juxtaposition of a way to put it, just draws you in more as a reader and sucks you more into the character and into the plot in a way that adult books don't necessarily do, especially if you're looking at realistic fiction. Because, you know, as an adult, you're taking a different long view as you look at areas and problems in your life, which is, you know, good. I mean, I love adult books because this character is dealing with the same issues I deal with and, you know, things I can relate to in my own life, but it doesn't have that same exuberant passion for like every little detail. On the other hand, that same exuberant passion for every little detail can be a little overdone and a little over the top. Like, oh, teens, come on. It's just a kiss. Chill out. Just chill out.
Well, that's what's nice about having these lists sometimes is to call out some of those sometimes and get the ones that aren't quite as overly exuberant, yes. Maybe.
But on the other hand, like, that's just realistic teenage dumb.
Right, right.
You know, like,
that's
they're
probably,
approaching
that's why we love
it's time. Yeah. But even, like, with real teens, I'm like, all right, guys, just chill out. Just chill. I need to go talk to some grown-ups for a while.
Yeah, I've never been a youth services librarian, so I've never, I mean, I've kind of done little things here and there, you know, I've run the teen program or something at my library a couple times, but yeah, I would imagine it just, it almost drains you as an adult to work with it. Some people I know get really jazzed up about it, and that really energizes them, especially people like Justin Henke in Chattanooga, just that energizes him and energizes other people to be around teens so much, but that it tires me out for long periods of time. I love having them in the library, but I'm happy to have some of my other staff work with them regularly.
I think that's one of the great parts about working at a smaller branch, where I get to help and do a little bit of everything for all age groups.
Right. Yeah.
Is because I don't focus solely on one age group. I get to play with everyone. And so I can take a break if a certain age group is just exhausting me. But then I can always go back to them, which is really helpful.
And I should say that's not specifically on teens. I get worn out by toddlers too. I have a toddler too, so they wear me out at home, much less at work. So. But it's also, yeah, you get that joy of the teens, everything's all new, but of course, and even toddlers, everything's all new, of course, too. And I mean, everything literally is all new for them. So. And you did used to do children's services with the younger kids before your current library. You made a note to me of something that I wanted to hear more about, your spreadsheet that you used to help plan out your story times.
Oh, yeah. And this is why I think they put me in management, is because I do everything via color-coded spreadsheet, including story time. But one of the things, and I love my story time spreadsheet, is I actually put all of my rhymes, like my action rhymes and my songs and my clapping rhymes and my knee bounces for the babies, into a spreadsheet. And I have it so, like, the rhymes in one cell, and then the next column is, like, whether it's Mother Goose or clapping or knee bouncing, and different pages are for different age groups, because often the rhymes that I use with, you know, my 0 to 12 month babies are not the rhymes I use with, you know, my 3 to 5 year olds. But it's great because I can sort it by type of rhyme then, because it's, you know, it's Excel. You just click and sort the data by type of rhyme. So when I'm planning my story time and I'm like, oh, I need another, like, action rhyme here to break it up, I don't know what I want to use, I can just go to the spreadsheet, sort by type of rhyme, and then just look at, like, all my action rhymes and then just copy and paste it into my story time plan. And then I have another one that tells me all the books that I've used in story time, because I do have my favorites. And if I didn't track when I use certain titles, then I'd read, you know, Dear Zoo every single week if I had my way. So then I have, like, the book and the author and then the date that I last used it, so I can sort and know when it's okay to read a book again. I'm like, oh, it's been a year. I can totally do that one. And I also, so one of the ways, when I have a smaller group, I can write down the names of the kids in the spreadsheet every week. And mm-hmm. It's kind of like, it's not really attendance, but then right before story time, I can go back and read the names of the last few weeks of kids. And everyone's like, wow, you remember names so well.
That's like when I was a kid, and we would take our cat to the vet, and the vet would walk in and say, oh, how's Samantha? I was like, oh, you remember my cat? Like, no, you just looked at the record right before.
Yes. Yes, I'm not as good with names anymore, just because at my old library, we had a story time room, and that only 24 people, including the librarian, you know, could be in the story time room. So it was a much smaller group, and we just did a lot more programs to accommodate everyone. Whereas in this branch is a very small branch, so I don't have a special, like, a separate programming space. We just do story time on the loft area, which can see a few hundred because it's just this big open space. And so story time's a lot larger. I went from having 24 people, including me, to upwards of like 50 to 75 on a regular basis. So sadly, I'm not as good with the names anymore just because there's so many kids every week and I don't even get to catch their names. But
And I'm going to get you to explain what you meant. You said something about the MLIS as useless professional hazing. And what do you mean by that?
So I am not a fan of the MLIS, as I don't think it's a good indicator of what library work is actually like. I don't think it necessarily prepares you well on a practical level for the field. And it's an offhanded comment I made years ago to a friend who was thinking about going to libraries, and she's going to take like a library science course, but it didn't really correspond with what she thought a library work was like. And I was like, it's not, you know, I mean, the MLIS, it's just like professional hazing. It's just something, it's just a hoop you have to go through. And this was really apparent to me because I have my MLIS, I spent a lot of money and I got it.
Yeah.
I went to Maryland, which is a very good program. But at the time I was working full time as a librarian. My old system had a level, and I know many systems have this, called library associate, which is basically you do all of the librarian work, but you don't have your degree, so you can't really advance. But your day-to-day is doing the same thing as the librarians do. And so I was doing that full time and then going part time to get my degree. And there were some things that were interesting, but everything that was like actually useful, I already knew. A coworker and I actually were told to just pass notes quietly back and forth to each other during cataloging class.
Because you already knew it.
We already knew it. Like, we were talking about Dewey. And she's like, you know, and the question's like, okay, well, what Dewey range do you think fairy tales would fall into? And the answer she was looking for was the 300s. And we were in the back. We're like 398.2.
Yep, that's what I was just thinking.
Yeah. You're like, what about cookbooks? And her answer was like 600s. Like, oh, the 640s. And she's like, you guys are ruining it. Like, just, you're not allowed to answer any more questions. Just like sit quietly in the back and not do anything.
It's like, yeah, I can give you the Dewey for Southern barbecue cookings.
Exactly. Exactly. And I was like, I'm paying how much money to be told not to do anything because I know all of this because I work in the field? And I think a lot of degree programs that are going to like where they have like you have to have an internship, you have to have work experience, but at the same time they're not letting you do that at a place you already work.
Mm-hmm,
and it's like, right. And when I was in library school, a lot of my classmates, like most of us had a day job. I mean, a lot of Maryland's classes were in the evenings because most of us had a day job, and most of us had a day job in the field, and we're supposed to somehow come up with an internship or work experience in addition to the 40 hours a week we already work at a library, but oh no, that doesn't count, and our classes. And there's a lot of it's like I had a few classes that were really, really good and really, really interesting, but to have like two or three classes I really enjoyed out of an entire degree program.
Right.
I'm not sure, like it was worth the money because I needed the letters after my name to do what I wanted to do professionally.
So what would you do differently? Do you think it is deserving of a master's degree even, or do you think it should be an undergraduate degree, or the things you think they could change to make better?
You know, actually, I think a lot of it could just be on-the-job training. I mean, a lot of the stuff I knew going into library school, like the most useful things I've ever done for training and learning how to be a librarian was stuff that I learned on the job or, you know, like mini classes that I've taken for professional development. You know, it wasn't like the formal schooling. And I think partly also because librarianship is just so vast as a profession, what's going to be useful to a public youth services librarian and what's going to be useful to a law librarian and what's going to be useful to like a database cataloger. You know, there's not a lot of common ground there, and there's definitely not, you know, an entire master's degree worth of common ground. And what you have for common ground isn't the practical day-to-day knowledge that anyone actually needs to do their job and do it well, and especially with things that are changing so much. I really do think that, you know, just a more focus on, you know, like almost like an apprenticeship program as you go in and just learning kind of on the field and on the job, and then doing a lot of the professional development stuff outside of a more formal, you know, schooling program. It's just a lot more useful to people.
Well, and I think the continuing education part of it is really important too, because mm-hmm. because things are changing so quickly, we have to kind of keep up. So it's sort of, you know, I mean, I graduated in 2004. And so things were a lot different when I was going to school in 2002, 2003. Mm-hmm. So you really have to keep up in the field. I mean, there were no e-books basically back then. So that whole thing is kind of new since then. So they didn't cover that at all in my graduate. You know, they were still talking about telling us what the internet was back then.
Well, I mean, like, I graduated in December of 08, and I had to take an information technology course. And like, the whole first chapter was about, there's this thing called email. And this thing called instant messaging. And I'm reading my chapter like I aming my friend going, oh my God. Did you know this is a thing that exists?
Yeah, I think that's part of the problem too, is a lot of the, I mean, there are some good programs that are keeping up better, but a lot of the programs I think are falling behind. And I know ALA does currently have a committee going to look at the standards. So maybe that will help some as well, as to update the standards, because I don't think the standards have been updated for a while on what it takes to be accredited.
Yeah, but I think also part of the problem is, and I know after I graduated, Maryland did this big shift, and I know Michigan did it a while ago, and a lot of the programs are shifting away from the more practical advice, and they're moving to like a purely academic program. I know one of the things I actually did like about my program was that most of my professors were adjuncts or lecturers. You know, they actually worked full time in the field at the National Archives or at the Smithsonian or the National Libraries of Health and Medicine or one of the universities. You know, they were actually librarians, and their day job was doing what they were teaching. And then they taught a class, you know, every other semester or something. But I know Maryland was really moving away from that and moving towards like the all academics side of things, and you know, which got a lot more theoretical and a lot more academic and just a lot less useful. And I think a lot of library programs are moving that way, and they're trying to get people, you know, going for like their PhD in information science, which is great, because I think that's where a lot of, you know, new software and new innovations are coming from. But at the same time, that's not where new librarians are coming from. And it's, you know, I think the people who think about information science and information architecture on a broader level, you know, are useful for programming and like services and like new software things, but that's not useful for librarians and having a master's program that's really just set up to create new PhDs. They're not creating new librarians. And I think a lot of the information science programs are going in that direction, which is unfortunate for people on the ground.
Right, getting away from the more, because a lot of the work that we're doing is more practical kind of stuff. I mean, it's nice to take the time to think about that stuff sometimes, but it's not necessarily what you're going to use in your day-to-day job. I mean, and there are people who will, but the vast majority of us are in branches and schools and universities, checking books out and cataloging books and doing stuff, not just being able to think in a broader sense.
Exactly. I need to know how to search a database. I need to know different ways of searching a database. I don't need to know how to build a database. I mean, people do. People need to build databases. I don't. I need to use a database. I don't need to build a database.
Right.
You know, I don't need to build a new ILS system. I don't need that kind of programming knowledge. I need the knowledge to ask intelligent questions and to use an ILS system. And they're different things, and they're related, but they are very different. And I think, you know, a lot of the more practical stuff that makes you actually good at being a librarian is the stuff that happens on the ground.
Right.
And in training and kind of professional development, working with other librarians and not necessarily in a classroom with students who haven't, you know, been on the other side of the reference desk before.
Yeah, it always seems odd when you go to library school with people who have never worked in a library before, and sort of you don't know what you're even getting into at this point, and you're not really going to find out here necessarily what you're going to be getting into. I mean, you'll learn how to do a reference interview maybe, but you know, you're not really getting the full experience unless you could. I mean, so even the way it is, like you said, you really have to have those internships and things like that, because I mean, you can't go just straight from library school to working at a library and really understand what you're getting into.
Exactly. And this steep learning curve, I think, that happens if you go straight from library school to working in a library, is the same steep learning curve you have just if you skip the library school step.
Right.
And thus you're going to learn the practical information. And I think, you know, reference is usually an intro class. It's one of the things you take in your first semester, but you're not going to do a reference interview for another 2 years if you're lucky enough to find a job right after graduation.
Right.
How much of reference do you really remember?
Yeah, no, I was working in libraries when I was in library school too, and that seems to be the easiest way. I did learn a lot more, I think, on the job than, I mean, it was sort of the library school was supplementing a little bit of what I was learning, but most of what I learned. And then if you make a switch, like I was working in university libraries when I was in library school, and then I ended up in public libraries, and so, you know, when I was in school, I actually thought I was going to be in academic libraries, and so I didn't take those public library classes.
Exactly.
So I didn't actually even learn what I'm currently doing.
No. Yeah, it was interesting because when I was in library school, I was actually majoring in archives and records management. I took, like, the only really public service class I took was young adult literature. And I took that mostly just because I wanted to.
Right.
And then my professor is like, why are you do archives and you're in this class? I'm like, well, I do archives at school, but I do teens at work.
Yeah, it's more, I mean, I, you know, at the time I liked the job that I had and I thought I was going to do all that, but public service is really more now that I'm, especially once I got into it. I mean, I've been in it now 7+ years now, but I mean, this is really more what I got into the field for in the first place.
Yeah, I initially, when I went into libraries, I wanted to be an archivist or a research librarian, probably working with an East Asian collection, because I minored in Chinese in college. And I worked in the archives. I worked in the college archives when I was an undergrad, and I really liked the job, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be, you know, an archivist or a reference librarian for, like, a special collection. And when we moved to D.C., I just kind of applied for any and every library job I could find, and I just kind of fell into children's services. And everyone thought, like, oh, that's such a bad fit. And I was like, well, you know, it'll pay the rent until I can get done with school, and then I can get, like, a quote-unquote real job. And by the time I started school, I ended up just falling in love with youth services, which no one saw coming, least of all myself. And then I was really torn when I started school, like, do I want to do a youth services track or do I want to continue to do archives? And what a lot of people don't realize is the bulk of the National Archives, like the main building of National Archives, isn't the one downtown on the mall where you can see the Constitution and the Declaration, but, like, most of the archives are actually on the University of Maryland campus. And so a lot of the professors, you know, were very high-level professionals at the National Archives. And one of my friends is like, well, if you ever want to do archives, you know, you should really take this chance and study with these people because you have the work experience for youth services. Like, everyone's going to look at your resume and know that you're fine for youth services. And so that's why I studied archives. But, you know, it's nothing I'm ever really going to do because I'm going to stay in public libraries because that's what I really enjoy doing and that's what I really like.
Right.
And I think that's where I found my spot. But, you know, I have this degree.
Right.
Archives. Because obviously it was super, super necessary for my public library career.
Well, having that MLIS at the end of your name will allowed you to get your current jobs.
Exactly. And some of the things I learned are good. And there were some really interesting conversations and interesting things, but really, you know, there were like two classes that were just super interesting and I really enjoyed. And, like, two classes that were super practical and actually useful. And there's actually an overlap of, like, one of the classes actually falls into both categories. So three classes out of an entire master's program that I don't think were a waste of money. And I know I'm not alone in this. Like,
right.
Every time I say, well, the MLS is just, you know, professional hazing, a lot of people smile and nod and agree with me.
Yeah, no, the discussion never ends on that.
Yeah.
Well, Jenny, where can people go to find out more about you online?
Okay. Well, I am on Twitter as Kid Silk Haze, which is a type of yarn that I really enjoy. I blog. I have a review blog called Bibliophile, and the URL for that is jenrothchild.com. And last year I did a project. It was just a year-long project, so I'm not updating it anymore, but I think it's still really useful. And it was called YA Reading List, and that was every day I had a themed reading list of books that people might enjoy. Like on Super Bowl Sunday, it was just football books, and on Charles Perrault's birthday, it was YA books that were retelling Perrault fairy tales. January was Blood Donor Month, so I had a lot of vampire books, that sort of thing. So you can find me there, but I'm on Twitter a lot, so you can look me up on Twitter.
All right. Well, Jenny, thank you so much for joining me today, and everybody can go there and find out more about you and converse with you on Twitter.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the podcast, you can visit circulatingideas.com, or you can follow the show on Twitter at @circideas or on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. And if you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can contact the show at circulatingideas.mail@gmail.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time.
So I'm confused about the economic structure and governance structure of Daniel Tiger's neighborhood. So they have a king. You know, King mm-hmm. Friday is the ruler. But according yeah. to, you know, his son, Prince Wednesday, he is just the boss of castle stuff. That is his job, is to be the boss of castle stuff. So I'm not sure, like, how much. And then there is an episode where he helps the kids vote on whether or not they can have a new swing set or a new slide for the playground. But they can't afford both. So I'm wondering here. Mm-hmm. But also, Prince Tuesday, the older prince, has a few odd jobs. He's not only Daniel Tiger's babysitter, but he's also a waiter at a restaurant. And I'm kind of interested to know, like, what kind of kingdom is your – you know, does your prince have to be a waiter? And do you have to spend extra money for, like, a protection detail?
Well, maybe
he's just going to be waiting on people? Is he allowed to accept tips?
Maybe that's the make-believe village version of, like, you know, where Prince William and everything had to be in the military and things
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. But interestingly enough, like, even when he's waiting, like, he has his waiter apron on and his cape and crown and sash with his, like, waiter apron.
Well, you just, yeah, I guess you just have to know who he is.
So. Yeah, I just, I've watched way too much Daniel Tiger.